happy Monday, everybody. Or if you're joining us later in the week, happy day to you. I hope you guys are feeling fresh and staying safe. And I want to take this second to remind you that this podcast is for you. So feel free to send me an email at jackie@lbpost.com. If you feel there's something in your community that needs more investigation, or if someone in your community is doing something amazing, please let me know that. If you'd rather send me a DM, you can do that on Instagram and Twitter at JRayTheFanatic. In the meantime, I'm feeling good because we have a fantastic show today. I have some amazing guests. Councilman and Vice Mayor Rex Richardson is here with me today, and I am going to take you into the Museum of Latin American Art and introduce you to social justice artist Judy Baca. So get comfortable and let's get to it. Welcome back to The Word on Long Beach, brought to you by the Long Beach Post. Once again, I'm Jackie Ray. Joining me right now is Councilman Rex Richardson, also serving as our vice mayor. Thank you so much for joining us from home. I appreciate you taking out the time. Now,
hey, thanks a lot. Happy to join you. I'm a fan of your work, Jackie Ray.
Thank you. Well, let's start off with a tough question then. And then
we can,
since you're a fan, this is a hard one. And I just want to ask you a personal question. So as a Black man in America, not a Black politician, I think we both know there's a difference, but as a Black man in America, and you understand the uphill battle that comes with being a Black man in this country.
Right.
And you scroll through social media, the news, and you see that we're kind of back in this perpetual state of drama when it comes to racial inequalities. And just a year ago, we had so many people say, yes, we want change. Yes, we're going to do what we need to do to make that change happen. As not a politician, but just as a Black man in this country, how does it make you feel to see we haven't done anything really to say, hey, yep, we're committed to this and we're going to make changes right away?
Look, you know, I my mother was a welder on the assembly line at General Motors. My father, you know, he was military police in the Air Force when I was a kid. They divorced when I was young. You know, we moved around a lot as a result. I went to, you know, 14 public schools across 5 states. You know,
wow.
I lived in down south in Alabama, where my mother is from. I've lived in St. Louis, where my father is from. And so I've seen I've experienced a lot of different communities. And I'll tell you, there are some common denominators out there. It's that within communities that are predominantly made up of people of color, you see certain things in common. You see, you know, poverty. You see lack of investment. You see lower educational attainment levels. You'll see schools that don't have the same levels of investment. You see people who whose lives are impacted by the war on drugs, by things like mass incarceration. You see all the impacts of those things. And it draws a bigger question, just as a Black man or as a person. What will it really take to change the paradigm in America? And and for me personally, I'm inspired. I'm inspired because, you know, I look back, I know my history, I know my roots, and I know that my ancestors and generations before me have dealt with worse. Mm-hmm. And that they've continued to strive to make a more perfect America. And this is our time. Just like the people who came before us and generations and movements before us, we all have that social responsibility to form a more perfect union, to continue to leave things in a better place than they were and you found them. That is a basic principle. And so, you know, when I think of the events of last year, you know, I'm thinking about a town hall that I saw President Obama participate in a couple months ago. It was a, you know, 5 years or so after My Brother's Keeper kind of update. And what he said was, the moment we're in America is the third Reconstruction. You know, obviously we know the first Reconstruction after the Civil War. That's when we saw major changes to voting rights and Jim Crow laws and all of those things established to reform America during that Reconstruction. The second major Reconstruction was after the 1960s, the Civil Rights Movement, which saw was the Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing. You saw the Civil Rights Act. These were major fundamental laws to really begin the process of eliminating Jim Crow and the Tale of Two Nations. And then what the president said was that this third Reconstruction that's happening after the events of George Floyd that woke up local cities to say, could institutional racism be impacting me on the ground in my community? It was a call to action on the local level. This Reconstruction is going to take place and be led by people on the ground, county supervisors, DAs, mayors, council people. Local governments are the ones who are going to look up and say, the local government is doing more now than it's ever been. Local government, all the burdens from realignment to homelessness, economic development, these are issues that used to be led by Congress and led by the state are now being led by cities. Due to gridlock, partisan gridlock in Washington and other things, local cities are taking the responsibilities. And if we want to see change, if we want to see equity, if we want to see a more perfect union, this Reconstruction is about redesigning your cities to be the examples. So if you look at things like universal basic income, that is a foundation for reparations. That's happening in cities. It's not happening at Congress. Mm-hmm. It's not happening on the federal level. If you think about the fight for 15, the living wage fight over the past few years, that took place in cities. Long Beach was one of the first cities to step up and say, we believe in a $15 minimum wage. And now it's law across California and is likely going to be federal law. So cities are now leading. And if we're going to really move forward on racial equity and governing for racial equity, it has a start on the ground in cities like Long Beach.
I love that you said that when I was out trying to help people vote. And I understand people's distrust in government, but I just kept hammering that home. It's your local. Don't look outside of your city. It's just like sometimes you got to get your house in order. Mm-hmm. Your local government is definitely getting your house in order. One of the things that I thought that was amazing, we have seen social activists basically singing the same song for quite some time. Unfortunately, George Floyd is not the first time we've seen a Black man die at the hands of police officers. It's not the first time we've seen protests. We did see a bigger protest nationwide, but even with that, we saw more governments, local governments, willing to say, hey, exactly what you said, it's time that we have a conversation. Mm-hmm. Again, this was not our first rodeo with this unfortunate incident. Why was this the one that said, no, now we have to listen and now we have to really take a step back and see how we can reflect locally?
Mm-hmm. I think the events of 2020, a lot of people were fed up with a lot of things. We had a pandemic that had some of the worst unemployment levels, and it exposed a lot of the issues within the Black community. The brown community, as it relates to health equity, the lack of health care, the over concentration of fast food and liquor stores in our community, and the lack of open space, freeways in our community contributing to poor air quality, all of those things. I think that was one piece, the pandemic. And then you had a very negative and divisive national election taking place with Donald Trump, who spent an entire 4 years trying to divide America. And so all of that played out, right? And what you see is the spark took place in Minneapolis. Now, it isn't to say that the spark couldn't have taken place anywhere else. Minneapolis is not that unique. I mean, they're smaller than the city of Long Beach. I sat on a panel with, in 2000, what was it, 2016. I sat on a panel at the White House. It was a My Brother's Keeper Summit under President Obama's last year in office. It was one of the great honors of my public service to be able to do that in our city. But I sat on this panel next to the mayor of Minneapolis, and she was also invited. It wasn't because Minneapolis has so many issues as it relates to race. It was because they were leaning in and Boys and Men of Color and made a commitment to racial equity within their city. And so they were being lifted up as a model. Now let's fast forward. From 2016 to 2020, just 4 years later, we have Derek Chauvin We have Mr. George Floyd. We have the video we all witnessed. And it really raised the question. If Minneapolis was just held up 4 years before as a city that's making the right commitments, and 4 years later, you saw a situation like that take place in their community, it really called on every city in America to check under the hood and say, if it can happen there, could it happen here? What is our real commitment to making sure that no matter your background, you can live a healthy and safe life within our city? It's a question that all of America had to ask. And we all did ask that question. And some cities leaned in and asked the question more publicly. And some cities didn't. And I'm proud of Long Beach. When it came to Long Beach, you know, we didn't duck our heads in the sand. We stepped up. We said, let's have the conversation now. We had hard discussions. We had town halls, virtual format. You know, people shared how they personally felt and were impacted by systemic racism. And you had city staff and our city manager sit through these and talk about the things that we can do on the ground to begin to acknowledge and institutionalize change. And what the process was called the Framework for Reconciliation in Long Beach, but the product was the Racial Equity Reconciliation Initiative initial report. 106 potential actions organized in four categories to really have tangible steps that the city can take to make a meaningful difference in our own city. And we're making tremendous progress. And I'm happy to talk about it, you know, if you want, but we're making tremendous progress there. But I do want to say, you know, our communities are living, breathing organisms. They're not, you know, a community is not just made up of buildings or statistics. Mm-hmm. Community is made up of people. And the laws and the systems surrounding that those people will cultivate how those people grow and thrive. It's like a garden. And so if you starve a garden of water for decades and decades, you can't just turn on the faucet and the garden comes right back. You have to make deep, deep investments back into the very soil of that garden in order to bear fruit. And so what we went through last year was acknowledging that the garden needs to be re-sown and reinvested in. We didn't just turn on the faucet. Mm-hmm. That was an acknowledgement of what is it going to take to re-sow the garden so it bears fruit that's productive for everyone. That's what the reconciliation plan was about, an acknowledgement and a plan to re-sow the garden.
I like that. I want to touch base on your racial equity and reconciliation initiative. And I definitely understand it. Equity is more than just police reform. Absolutely. But I think when you're talking about sisters, brothers, husbands, wives, mothers, daughter, there's a genuine fear when it comes to even just getting pulled over for a regular traffic incident or having a fake, what is it, $20 bill or something like George Floyd had. So I'm not surprised that when you were going through the report of that, more than half the people surveyed cited defunding the police as a top priority, because I think it's that fear. And you just want to be safe driving down the street. And I know in that, you said 34 police officer positions were supposed to be cut. That did not happen. Can you tell me why?
So let's be clear. The budget action last year was due. The budget action last year was due to the fact that as a local city, our revenue, all of our revenue sources did not come in as projected, largely because of the pandemic. So local cities in Long Beach specifically, we balance our budget based on a diverse source of revenue streams. And we're fortunate to have a diverse source of revenue streams. So you have property tax, you have sales tax, you have transit occupancy tax. That is your, you know, your hotel taxes, tourism in Japan. You even have an uplift fund that helps the general fund, which is oil that's produced within the city of Long Beach.
Okay.
It's still balanced general fund. You also get transfers from the special, our enterprise funds, like the port. There's a transfer every year that helps our general fund. When the pandemic happened, downtown closed, the tourism district closed. It was hard to get sales tax. People were buying things online.
Mm-hmm.
But that took most of our revenue sources and they evaporated. And so I know there was a lot of talk about defund the police and all of those things. But I think we have to be able to acknowledge what truly happened last year. Last year, we had budget cuts as a city. But there was no direct, you know, there's no reference in the plan to directly cut PD, abruptly cut PD and invest those directly into services. That isn't in the plan. What's in the plan, it does acknowledge If you invest upstream, you invest in real community health, alternative forms of response, like the REACH model we just rolled out, that sends clinicians and nurses out to address homelessness. That came directly out of the reconciliation plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's rolling out. We have two REACH teams that are working in conjunction with the HEART team to address proactively police response to homelessness. And so those things are happening. There is a strategy around civilianization as well that the city manager is proposing. And so the things that we committed to within the plan are moving forward. And the budget actions committed to within the plan are taking place. In fact, there was 106 recommendations. 98 of those recommendations are at different stages of implementation.
That's fantastic. How do you change the mindset of police officers, though? Because I don't want to gloss over that. I don't want to gloss over the fact that when I get pulled over, it's a little bit different feeling and understanding that I have to keep my hands on the wheel. I can't make any sudden moves. And that's that doesn't come from nowhere. That comes from experience that I've had, experience that you've had, experience that my dad has had. There is a disconnect. And so how do you convince a community that doesn't feel safe when it comes to law enforcement? How do you convince them that, hey, reducing the police force is not necessarily a good thing, or you can feel safe calling 911? How do you address both of those things?
So here's a couple of things. And I think you nailed it when you say, you know, this is people's experience. And I can tell you, you know, just growing up, going through the age of as a young man, I've been cuffed and put in the back of a police car more than one occasion. I've been searched. All of these things have happened to me growing up. I've been detained, detained and questioned because I fit the description. It's happened to me growing up. I have a brother that's 4 years younger than me. I watched it happen to him as well. So it's real. When people talk about the anxiety that you might feel, it's not based on television. It's not based on propaganda. It's based on lived experience and what people pass down from one generation to the next. And so on the other hand, you know, the question you had about the community, I think we have to have real honest conversations. And the honest conversation is this: the city is an organization, and that organization has to function and it's interdependent on each other. The police department, the fire department, are integral parts of that organization. Keeping a community safe, that is an important part of that conversation. Now, the definition of safety, that is a community discussion. To me, safety means having good lighting on my streets as well. It means making sure that our streets are active, our parks are active, and that they're programmed. It means that I have access to the resources that I need to thrive. Access to things that help make a neighborhood and not land uses that pull a neighborhood down. All of these things are investments that have to happen. If you look at, you know, I'm always looking at if an incident happens, there's a shooting, a bad incident that happens, always looking at what else is around there. I guarantee you there's likely going to be a liquor store somewhere near there or a motel somewhere near there. If you look at my policy record, I've taken on nuisance liquor stores in the city, and I took on nuisance hotels in the city. That's the people's agenda. They wanted to stop crime happening in their neighborhood. They were directly connected to land policy. The point I want to kind of end with is you cannot just turn on the faucet and the garden comes back.
Right.
You have to begin to re-sow the garden.
I like that analogy, but from a landscaping perspective, you can dig it up and start over. And I think that's kind of what people are at. I hear what you're saying 100%. However, when I hear people say defund the police, I understand where that comes from. You don't want people in your community who don't have love or respect for you, and their first go-to is you're someone who they need to defend themselves against. When I was in Saipan for 2 years, the reason why that police force did not have that is because everybody knew everybody. Everybody was from that community. They had love for that community. They probably knew little Tommy, like, come on, Tommy, let me take you home. There was that love.
Right.
That's not what we experience in our communities. We don't experience people who understand that community, who love that community, and have to live within that community. So I think when you're, if you're not going to defund the police, at bare minimum, it should be, let's encourage people who grew up from this community, who understand this community, to police this community. But you can't feel about me the way that you do and then come into this community. It has to be one or the other. Do we have anything in place that would encourage Black and Latino people to police their own communities, to get into the police force?
Yeah, and we do. And so, and we do, and we should do more. And so, you know, as with respect to police and fire diversity, you know, with firefighters, we've, you know, gotten a whole apparatus within our firefighter firefighter department, with a coordinator and all of that, that focus on outreach and diversity. Within the police department, you have the Explorers program and all these other things. And what we have to do is continue to make sure those available to our kids in our communities, Jordan High School, Cabrillo High School. We need to make sure that we have policies in place that ensure things like implicit bias training, or even require, you know, ethnic studies, ethnic studies courses. If you're going to get credit for your bachelor's degree, make sure that it's, you have ethnic studies courses. That was a bill that the state of California passed last year. There was another thing that was really important that would have allowed us to use preferences based on race and locality last year. You know, that was to get rid of Prop 209 to bring affirmative action back. That measure failed. But if you look where Long Beach was, you know, we put it on the record. Long Beach took a position in support of that measure, and we, you know, and many of us in Long Beach advocated very, very firmly there. And so there have been efforts, and we need to continue, and they're referenced within the reconciliation plan, other things we can do to diversify our communities.
One of the things that I found myself covering is why the Black and Latino community don't get vaccinated as much, and across the board is a distrust for government. I think that's the overlining theme with this whole situation. Right. There is a distrust for police that's warranted and makes sense. There's a distrust for government that's warranted and makes sense. We've kind of talked about how you address that with the police. How do we restore the community's faith, especially in their local government, that, hey, let's not worry about what's going on over there. Here in Long Beach, we hear you. We're going to restore your faith and make you see that we're trying to move to a better tomorrow.
Well, that's the thing. We have to. So, you know, local government has taken on more responsibilities. We talked about that. And this is not just this year. This has been an ongoing trend. Mm-hmm. You know, leadership that's been shown from Congress and Washington has eroded because of partisanship, gridlock. We're not committed to, we're not the traditionalist generation that came out of, you know, World War II, built the pension system, built Social Security. You know, everyone gets a house and a dog in the backyard and, you know, 2.5 kids, right. Not the generation. Well, our generation, one thing that we've learned is how to think on our feet, how to be resilient, how to adjust to all of this globalization, things that are happening. That's what we've grown up to learn. It's the truth. And so I say all that to say, local government is probably the most stable form of government. That is where it's most accessible. You can step up and run for office yourself. You can run for school board yourself. Raise the money, get to know your neighbors, and get it done. And you're going to have a charge that previous councils and mayors didn't have.
For people who are, you know, and I get it, you know, because I understand I feel like a lot of us, we've been singing the same song for a while, and our voice is going out. We're tired of singing. So I think if you could leave one encouraging word to people who are just a little bit tired, what would that be?
It's a good question. Let me spend a second on that. You know, this is going to sound a little cliche, but I believe in it 100%. You know, we are the ones we've been waiting for. The change you want to see in the world, you need to become that change. Be the one to step up and lead and make those changes happen. Because I've seen incredible things happen right here in my own life and in my own community. And it all starts with having the audacity and the determination to step up and say, I'll do it. I'll go first. Send me, I'll go. And so I encourage you, Long Beach, you know, no problem is too big for us to tackle. But we need all of us to step up, and everyone should just go in and get it done.
Huge thank you to Councilman and Vice Mayor Rex Richardson. I was so focused on the serious nature of our conversation that I forgot to plug the fun and good time that is coming up, which is crazy to me because I've always wanted to interview the legendary Sheila E. And thanks to Rex Richardson, she is going to be here in Long Beach for the 10th Annual Jazz Festival. The best way to get all the details about that is to go to his Facebook page at facebook.com/RexRichardsonLB. But guys, make sure you're there. It's going to be fantastic. There's going to be a white party on Friday. The Jazz Festival happens on Saturday. There's no place else you're going to want to be. I'm also very excited about my next guest. Again, I'm giving you something to do. So make sure you stay tuned because we're going to go inside the Museum of Latin American Arts and we're going to talk about Judy Baca. Stay with us.
The Word on Long Beach is brought to you by Community Hospital Long Beach. Community Hospital is now open, serving the community since 1924 and singularly focused on providing patients with the very best in healthcare services. Community Hospital, restored, reopened, reimagined.
Welcome back to The Word on Long Beach. Once again, I'm Jackie Ray. And let me tell you, I love going on location. So I was really excited to do this next interview. I got to go on location to the Museum of Latin American Art. They have an amazing art exhibition right now featuring the work of Judy Baca. She's an artist that uses her gift to promote change. And I met with Gabriela Utiaga to get more insight into the social significance of this exhibit. Take a listen. Tell me how long you've been with the museum.
Thank you, Jackie, for having me. I am Gabriela Urtiaga, the chief curator at the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach, California. I just moved from Buenos Aires, Argentina to Long Beach 2 years ago. In September, we will celebrate 2 years in the U.S. And I am so happy because MOLA, the Museum of Latin American Art, is a pioneer of museum to put in the focus in Latin American and Latino artists in the U.S. And you know, this is really important for our community and for our artists too.
Absolutely. Now, how long has this museum been here in Long Beach?
Well, you know, this year we will celebrate the 25th anniversary.
It's been 25 years already.
Exactly. Oh, it's an amazing opportunity to continue to thinking about the rich culture of Latin America and, you know, Chicanos, Latinos, artists here.
Now, how did you get this job? You've only been in the States for 2 years. How did you come to become the curator here?
Yes, you know, this is a big challenge and it's an amazing opportunity, not only for me, like a Latina and Argentinian girl, a curator, is because I really know the importance to talk and to share knowledge about Latinos and Latin American artists in the U.S. around the world. And this is a big opportunity, so amazing. And we are working a lot with all the MOLA team to do this play. An amazing place, a community place too.
We're going to see a lot more art. For those of you who are watching this on YouTube, make sure, or listening to us, make sure you check out the YouTube because we're going to see a lot of different art. Some of it looks more modern. Some of it looks older. What goes into the process of getting the art into the museum?
Well, you know, for example, now we are in the process of our new master plan of acquisition to put in balance diverse our collection regarding gender, you know, women artists, men artists, Latinx, African Latinx artists. And the idea is that the artwork is contained a lot of information, a layer of information, not only an aesthetic experience, but also they contain a lot of stories of life. Mm-hmm. And this is really important for our museum, for our audience, to share and build a lot of knowledge about art, but also about the story,
right?
You know?
So this current exhibition. What went into this? Are all these artists, are they similar in some way? How did this exhibition come about?
Well, we are so happy because, you know, we are now in the first retrospective of one of the most important Chicana artists, muralist, and community leader, Judy Baca. And the name of this retrospective is Judy Baca, Memorias de Nuestra Tierra. And we present in our curatorial perspective the intersection of the artistic practice of Judy Baca, but also her commitment with social issues. And you can see through different galleries the her long career to talking about women power, mm-hmm. to talking about the identity of Chicanas, Latinas, women of color through her art. Mm-hmm. But also you can see a lot of many iconic murals in our galleries that Judy worked with different artists around the world. Mm-hmm. And this is the power of art because Judy thinks the art like an instrument of social change. And you can see all the details in different galleries and in different sculpture, installation, photographs, and painting, of course.
Now, I see definitely a lot of, I see Gandhi, I see there's even, like you said, the African Latino community that's represented. I think a lot of our listeners on this show specifically, we talk a lot about, you know, social change and pushing that needle. And you talked about knowledge and educating people on art. How can art help push the social change, push that needle?
You know, the artists are the avant-garde of our time. And they are thinking all the time about a creative process, but also they are immersed in our context. And it's for that we really know the power of art. You can see, for example, one piece, but it's not about only your knowledge, because you can connect directly with a lot of layers of information in a painting and in a sculpture. And the most important thing is when you are in connection with art, with the artist, you can feel that. You know, and I think this is the power of art, and this is one of the most important missions of a museum, mm-hmm. to talk about, to be involved in the context that we are living, and at the same time to thinking about the past, the present, but also the future.
Right.
And with Judy Baca, you can see that she's looking, always talking about the silent voices of our time. And this is the power, and this is the beautiful experience that you can see and feel in this kind of exhibition. And this is the first retrospective of Judy Baca, you know? I can't believe it, but I am happy because MOLA has the opportunity to present of our community, this kind of art is so necessary in our time.
Right.
And I think Judy was always here, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. help people to learn more about the story, about the unofficial story too. And she created an amazing pieces, an amazing large painting to talk about. And at the same time, she's helping a lot of people, but she's sharing knowledge, culture, and to see the future together. Judy Baca mm-hmm. is a native from the city of Los Angeles.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
So when she started her, do you know when she started her artistic journey?
Yes, she started in the 60s,
okay.
And one of the most important details is that she was studying with one of the most important Mexican muralists, David Alfaro Siqueiros, in the 70s. Mm. And you know, she told me that when she was in contact with a lot of information and knowledge of David Alfaro Siqueiros, she changed immediately the vision of art.
Okay.
As an instrument of social change. Mm. And it's for that she continued to do that. And you know, she's a woman, a muralist woman, and this is amazing because she really loved to work in community with young people. And a lot of mural that you can see here, and one of her masterpieces is the Great Wall in San Fernando Valley. Mm. She worked with a lot of young people in that area, and it was a transformation.
Right.
And you can see the murals, but also the stories in the murals, because the murals are the reflection of our time, you know? And it's not only an aesthetic experience, but also is a lot of information about the community.
So one of the first things I found out about Gabriella when I walked in is that we're both Laker fans. So I wanted to, I don't know if you saw, there was a young lady in Akron who, I can't believe it, but this was the first mural that had ever been painted for LeBron James or featuring LeBron James in Akron, Ohio. Beautiful mural. She's young. It was her very first mural, and people went and defaced the mural. Unfortunately, I see that a lot here in our city as well. People will take the time to paint these beautiful murals that really are a representation of that city and the people that are in it. So to the people that are painting those, first of all, we appreciate you and congratulations. But to those who feel like it's okay to go out and deface those kinds of murals, what would you say to them?
You know, the murals are the reflection of our time. Mm-hmm. And we need to protect and care of the mural, because it's not only about the artists or who do that mural. It's also a representation of the community. And this is the most important thing. We need to celebrate the murals, of course, with respect, and because, you know, the murals are for everywhere and from everyone. You can see the artwork, you can see the painting, and a beautiful creation, and also you can think about it. Right. And this is the most important thing, right? To celebrate art.
One of the pieces we've done for the Long Beach Post were our street vendors and some of the disrespect that they were getting. And then right behind us is a beautiful street vendor display. So again, it's one of those moments where you're literally bringing in the culture that's immediately around us. And I think that's so important. I think maybe people don't know. One of the things that you really said that stood out to me is we all need to learn how to compromise with each other. And when I don't think that this exhibit is just for our Latino Mexican population. Why is this important for everyone to come out and see?
You know, first of all, because Judy Baca is one of the most important artists from LA, and we need to support her career, her commitment, and experience, this aesthetic experience too.
Right.
You know, it's really important, and she's part of the art history. And we need to learn and know more about her creative process. It's for that we present different drawing, coloration, mural, sculpture, photographies. You can find a lot of objects in her artistic career. And she's one of the most important activists, too, around the world. And it's not only for Latinos and Latin American, it's for all people that have the sensibility to connect with art, mm-hmm. you know? And this is a celebration. When you visit a museum, I really love to think that you maybe be different when you go out.
Yes.
Because you connect with the power of color, with the power of a beauty sculptor, and you continue to think about the exhibition. And this is so beautiful.
Now there's an immersive part of this exhibition as well. Can you tell me about that?
Well, we are so happy because we create an immersive experience of one of the most masterpieces of Judy Baca, that is the Great Wall in San Fernando Valley. And you can see here at MOLA the complete mural and the process of creation during different years in our gallery.
Okay.
And it's because Judy is always talking and looking for new alternatives to talk about a different topic, but also to create art in different way. And it's for that we decide to present the mural, one of the most long mural in the world in our gallery through the immersive experience.
That's amazing. People should definitely come out and see this. How long is this exhibition going to be here?
Until January.
Okay, yes. So plenty of time.
Exactly. You have time to schedule and visit us and celebrate Shudibaka creation.
That's fantastic. Now, when January comes, obviously there's going to be another. What goes into putting an exhibition in the museum?
Well, this is a beautiful experience because, for example, this year we decide to present women artists in our galleries, you know, and you can find a beautiful exhibition regarding women artists in MOLA collection, that they are part of our collection, and linking with the ideas of surrealism. Okay. And representation and borders and distortion. And you can find in different artists from different countries, from Latin America and, of course, from U.S. to talk about.
Yeah.
And next week we will present an emerging artist whose name is Gabriela Sanchez, native from LA.
Okay.
And you can see videos, pictures, sculpture, and big painting with one of the most important young artists.
This is so great. I'm so honored. I'm definitely going to take a moment and take in the art. So those of you who are on our social media, make sure you check it out. There's going to be a lot to see. Is there anything you would want to add before we end?
Oh, Jackie, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. And I would like to invite all of you to visit us and celebrate together the art, you know, the knowledge and the culture.
Now, don't forget, you can and should see that exhibition anytime between now and January. The Museum of Latin American Art is open Wednesday through Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. And you can find out more if you visit molaa.org. Once again, I am Jackie Ray. Thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget you can message me on all things social media at JRayTheFanatic, especially if you have something that you think needs a little bit more attention here in the city of Long Beach. You guys be safe. Have a fantastic week, and I will see you next time.